I'm very, very pleased indeed to welcome Dr. James Mallinson, who's an expert in the yoga traditions. He wrote he translated and edited the critical edition of the Kecheri Vidya by Adinath, which was published by Routledge a couple of years ago. And it's an exemplum of how to do how to critically edit and translate a text. It's a wonderful book, so I greatly encourage you to look at it and maybe buy it if you haven't seen it.
You can afford it.
If you can afford it. He's made some interesting new discoveries that we're going to hear about today. He's also, if I believe I'm correct, one of the world's greatest hang gliders. Is this not?
Quite a good paraglider.
Paraglider. Yes, it is.
There's not much difference.
Outstanding juggler.
Outstanding juggler.
Quarter blue, no less.
So I'm very, very pleased indeed to welcome Dr. Mallinson, who's going to speak to us today on the Siddhas, Munis and Yogins, but no Nats, the early history of Hatha Yoga.
Thank you very much indeed, and thanks very much everyone for coming. I wasn't expecting such a good turnout, and Imre, oh, hello Imre, thank you for coming. And which is very exciting for me, because this work I'm going to talk to you about, this new research, I've not really run by anyone at all, so very looking forward to lots of criticism and constructive feedback, I hope. Thank you very much, Gavin, for this opportunity to speak to everyone. And as you said, my area of expertise is Sanskrit works on Hatha Yoga, and I've also spent quite a lot of time in India living with traditional yogis who still practice Hatha Yoga. And now what prompted me to sort of really get into researching this was I was asked to write an article for a volume that Professor Lorenzen from Mexico is editing on. The title of the volume is The Literature of the Nat, or the Nat sect and their literature or something. So that prompted me to look into what their literature really was. You know, that they are, I'm sure most of you know, that they're almost universally accredited with having written all texts on Hatha Yoga. Hatha Yoga and the Nats are almost interchangeable. Lots of people talk about Nat Yoga. When I edited the Kecheri Vidya, I started suspecting that, because there was nothing that I could see that had anything to do with the Nat text, apart from the attribution in some of the colophons of the text to Adinatha. So my approach to this, the first thing I had to do was establish, the first thing I wanted to look into was the early text. The Nats, as I said, are credited with being the originators of Hatha Yoga. So I wanted to establish a corpus of texts, of early Hatha Yogic texts. And it was a fairly difficult thing to do because they've been so little studied and there was no particularly good starting point. But apart from a man called Christian Bui wrote a very fine work called the Le Yoga Upanishad et le Natha Yogin about 15 years ago. And in that, he showed convincingly that the Hatha Pradipika, which can be dated to about 1450, was for the most part a compilation. And he identified several texts. And you'll see on the first page of the handout, I haven't marked the ones that he identified. I've then identified a few more. And the numbers in brackets are the verses that these texts share with the Hatha Pradipika. And then there's a few other texts which I've added, which teach Hatha Yoga and can be shown to be earlier than the Hatha Pradipika. So right, I'll move on to this. Now I've gone into all these texts in quite a lot of detail, but I haven't got time to analyse them all. So there's two columns, as you can see. On the left, all those texts have, there's no claim anywhere in any manuscripts or within the texts themselves that they're anything to do with the Nats. There are a few claims in secondary literature, but I'm not going to deal with those now, haven't got time for that. As you can see, most of them don't share that many verses, if any at all, with the Hatha Pradipika. And several of them, well, four or five, come from a very sort of orthodox tradition that would have, you know, not surprisingly, would have nothing to do with the sort of supposedly heterodox tantric knots, and those are texts such as the Uttara Gita, which is it's from the Bhishma Parvan of the Mahabharata, and it's sort of modelled on the Bhagavad Gita. Then there's the Laghu Yoga Vasistha, the Yoga Yajnavalkya, which are from fairly sort of relatively orthodox traditions, and the Vasistha Sanghita. Then there's a couple of tantras in there, the Kula Chudamani Tantra is just half a verse, the Sharada Tilaka, the early Yoga Upanishads. There, in Christian Bui's book, he showed how you can divide the Yoga Upanishads into two bodies, an early one, and then in the 18th century, there was a South Indian Brahmin called Upanishad Brahma Yogin who put together a corpus of 108 Upanishads, but he didn't have enough, it seems, so he devised a few more, of which quite a lot of the later Yoga Upanishads were included in them, and they were sort of pastiches of existing texts on Hatha Yoga, but I'm not going to deal with them now because they're much later. So these early Yoga Upanishads, they've got things like the Brahma Vidya, Kshurika, Nada Bindu, Brahma Bindu, Amrita Bindu, and they're mainly concerned they teach a sort of Vedantic yoga which doesn't have any of the Hatha yoga sort of physical techniques, mainly emphasizing mantra repetition and nada yoga. Then on this list is the Dattatreya Yoga Shastra, which is a very interesting text which I'm going to return to quite a bit, and it's second only to the Viveka Martanda in the number of verses it shares with the Hatha Pradipika. Then in this list of texts with no knot association, there's the Sharangadhara Padati, which is a big anthology of verses from over 300 texts. It's about 5,000 verses long, and it has a fairly lengthy section at the end, and it can be dated pretty accurately to 1363. And it also takes lots of verses from the Dattatreya Yoga Shastra, a few from the Viveka Martanda, quite a few from the Markandeya Purana, in which there's five of the adhyayas in the Markandeya Purana it's a dialogue between Alarka and Dattatreya, in which again Dattatreya teaches Hatha Yoga, although he doesn't call it as such. In fact, that's something which I'm not going to go into in too much detail, the name Hatha Yoga. I know that Jason's working a bit on that at the moment, but it's actually quite confusing when you try and analyse when it's used. Even within the texts themselves, they seem quite confused as to the distinctions between Hatha Yoga, Raja Yoga, and then they also often make a group of four with Laya Yoga and Mantra Yoga. And we'll come to a couple of verses from the Sharangadhara Padati, which try to distinguish between various sorts of Hatha Yoga. But again, it's not, the distinction seems slightly forced. Now, as I said, in none of these texts is there any mention of Naats or any attribution to Naats. The Sharangadhara Padati does mention Goraksha at one point, but it's clearly not a Naat text, and it doesn't mention an order of Naats or yogis or anything like that. Then there's the Hatha Pradipika, which people may be surprised to see in this list. And I'm going to go into that in a bit more detail later on, but that's also, as I said, it's a compilation, but it's very eclectic and very inclusive. It mentions various siddhas who later became Nath gurus, but nowhere does it talk of a specific order or tradition. And it seems to mention everything going at that period that was anything to do with yoga. So, I mean, I think there's a bit further on, on page three, bottom of page three, there's a couple of verses in which there's a list of all these synonyms at the end of the verse, Ekavachakaha. So Raja Yoga, Samadish, Chaunmani, Manunmani, Amaratvam, Layas, Tattvam, Shunyashunyam, Parampadam, Amanaskam, Tatadvaitam, Niralambam, Niranjanam, Jivan Muktishcha, Sahajaturya, Cheti, Ekavachakaha. Ekavachakaha. So they're all synonyms, and these are all sort of different aims of various different approaches and methods of yoga. And again, within the Hatha Pradipika, there's no metaphysics. Very strikingly, there's no system of chakras. You know, it's seen as one of the basics of the practice of Hatha Yoga is the chakra system. But at the time that it was compiled, there were several systems of chakras. So I think you didn't want to prioritize one and then annoy people who practiced other systems. That's my only explanation. Literally mentions the word chakra once, but doesn't go into any systems. Again, finally, of the text with no Nath association is the Yoga Shastra of Hemachandra, which is a Jaina work, and I only recently noticed this, but there's two verses. They're not identical, but they're clearly either come from the same source or the Hatha Pradipika is a paraphrase of those verses, because that was composed in the 11th century, I think.
Did you give us the date already of the Hatha Pradipika?
About 1450. It's not completely conclusive, but I think that seems pretty likely. Yes, anyone, please do stop me and ask any questions if anything's not clear. No. Okay, we'll move on to the texts attributed to Nath. The first is the Amrita Siddhi, which is a very interesting text. It's probably 12th century. It's not been edited. And the reason we know how old it was is because manuscripts were taken to Tibet and it was translated, and then by 1322 it had become a canonical work of yoga in Tibet. It's the source of only 2.5 verses in the Hatha Pradipika, but 18.5 in the Shiva Sankhita and 2.5 in the Amaroga Prabodha, which I'll come to. And then it's also cited a lot in commentaries all the way through to the 19th century, and for some reason it's sort of been overlooked. I've got a couple of manuscripts of it, and I haven't. I can't read Tibetan, but I'm sure, you know, there's obviously plenty of Tibetan sources as well. It teaches. I think it's the earliest work I've come across which teaches the three bandhas. Jalandhara bandha, Maha bandha, Mahamudra. Uddiyana bandha, and the three grantis. But it makes no mention of Kundalini. Doesn't have chakras and doesn't call its yoga Hatha. Now, it's attributed to Virupaksha fairly universally. And in fact, in the manuscripts I have of it, which are from Jodhpur, the beginning of the 19th century, in that it's attributed to Virupaksha Natha. But you've got to be very careful with these manuscripts from Jodhpur, the beginning of the 19th century, because the Naths were ruling the state and were behind all these manuscripts being copied. So. But because in the earlier tradition, this Virupa or Virupaksha plays no part in the earlier tradition of the Nats. I found no references to him anywhere, although he's a very important siddha amongst the Tibetans, one of the Mahasiddhas. Now, the next three works, the Kaula Gyana Nirnaya, Matsyendra Sanghita, and Chandravalokana, are all attributed to Matsyendra. And I haven't been able to consult the Chandravalokana. That's it's only in manuscripts. And Christian Bowie, I asked him because he's got a copy of it, but he couldn't find it. So I haven't been able to look at it. But it's only 30 verses long, and apparently there's no mention of Nath in there either. Then there's the Kaula Gyana Nirnaya, which is an old text. The oldest manuscript of it is from the 11th century. But Matsyendra, I'm sure most people maybe have heard of him or know his myth. He is, in later Nath lineages, he's often named as the first or the second Nath after Adi Nath, and he is meant to have been Goraksha's guru. But a legend told about Matsyendra and Goraksha is that Matsyendra sort of fell from grace or lost his way and went to Kadali Desa, which was a country populated only by women, and he was enjoying himself in the palace of the queen, listening to lovely music all the time and getting drunk and having a great time. And Goraksha, his pupil, heard about this and somehow managed to disguise himself, get into the country, get into the palace, and then through most of the stories he's playing a drum, and he manages to beat out this rhythm that Jago Machandra Gorakaya, wake up, Matsyendra, I'm here. And then Matsyendra suddenly comes to his senses, and Goraksha re-instructs him in the true way, and they escape from the country. But that's sort of, that's interpreted as Goraksha reforming Matsyendra's Kaula practices. Matsyendra, we know, existed, was around at least from 900 CE, and he's always credited with the with developing the Yogini Kaula school, Kaula Tantrism. And then Goraksha, who, hard to date, but probably 12th or 11th century. So the chart, you know, it's very unlikely that they ever came across each other. And it seems to me that the myth and the position of Matsyendra in the guru lineage is a way of appropriating that earlier teaching and then showing that Goraksha reformed it. So I get within these texts, there's nothing that talks of any Nath Sampradaya as such. The Kaula Gyana Nirnaya does mention the Yogini Kaula school, but there's no mention within the later Nath sources of a Yogini Kaula school. So I don't think there's a, you know, that could be argued to represent a Nath Sampradaya. The Matsyendra Sanghita is another very interesting text, very long, and it's been edited, or most of it's been edited, by Shubba Kiss here in Oxford. And he, what's he called? A yogini-centered 13th century yoga text of the South Indian Shambhava cult. And again, it makes no mention of a Nath order. There's a frame story. It's a long text, 55 puttalas, and in the first and last puttalas, Goraksha does figure as Matsyendra's disciple, but it seems very likely that those puttalas were added to the text. Because in fact, Matsyendra's name only comes in once in the whole of the rest of the text, which is several thousand verses. So it's, even its attribution to him seems slightly dubious. Then there's the Khetri Vidya, which I've edited. Attributed to Adinatha in manuscript colophons, but through analysis of the text, I've shown that, again, it probably comes from a Kaula school. There's no mention of Naths. There's no reason from anything within the text to suggest that it was anything to do with a particular sampradaya of yogis other than an earlier Kaula tradition. Okay, now we move on to the... I'm going through this rather fast. I've got pages and pages on all of these, but I don't want to get held up. Now I'm going to move on to the five texts attributed to Goraksha, the first of which is called the Viveka Martanda, and as you can see, it shares the most verses with the Hatha Pradipika of any text. Now, I call it the Viveka Martanda. It's more commonly known today as the Goraksha Shataka, and it's been known by 20 names at least, or 15 names. Bowie lists them in his book. The most popular name is now Goraksha Shataka, which is fairly odd in that the shortest sort of the shortest coherent version is 160 verses, and most of them are 180, 190. The name appears to have changed. If you look at the manuscript tradition, in about the 16th century is when it starts being called the Goraksha Shataka. There is, its oldest manuscript is from, I think it's about 1480, and in that it is said to have been written by Goraksha Raya. But if we look at, it's, as I said, it's cited quite a lot. Well, it's used a lot in the Hatha Pradipika. It's used in the Sharangadhara Padati. It's cited quite a lot. And both these texts quite often attribute... They mention Goraksha, the Sharangadhara Padati only once, but then introduces a section on a type of yoga. And none of the verses which it introduces as being part of Goraksha's yoga come from the Viveka Maratanda, which suggests to me that if the text already at that time was attributed to Goraksha, wouldn't be the case. Similarly, none of the verses, there are various points, various places in the Hatha Pradipika where practices are introduced as being the yoga of Goraksha, but none of those are from the Viveka Martanda. That seems to come in other places. I've written pages and pages about this, so I'm not going to be able to go into complete detail, but Yes, the practice of nadanusandhana, which is the listening to the internal sound, which is there's a long passage describing that at the end of the Hatha Pradipika, and that is introduced as being the words of Garakshanatha, but nadanusandhana doesn't figure at all in the Viveka Mratanda. I mean, it's not completely conclusive, this, but I think it's unlikely that at the time of the composition of those texts it was attributed to Goraksha. And within the text itself there's no mention of Nats. Obviously these later versions called things like Goraksha Shataka at the beginning and end, the closing passages, they mention Goraksha and they say how it's the teaching of Goraksha, but the older manuscripts don't have those passages in them, including the one I mentioned from 1480 or so, which is attributed to Goraksha, but within the text there's no mention of him. Then there's another text you see below called which the oldest manuscripts of it do call it the Goraksha Shataka, and it is 100 verses long, and it's a coherent text. But none of the manuscripts are very old, but obviously it was around at the time of the Hatha Pradipika. The only mention, it teaches a Kundalini-based yoga. In fact, it's quite interesting because it teaches, well, for me, after my Khichdi Vidyar work, it teaches, there's lots of, there's a 10 or 20 verses on what it calls Shakti Chalini Mudra, which in later Hatha yogic texts is very convoluted and confusing and doesn't seem to make any sense at all, involving tying belts around your waist and rubbing. But this text teaches it as involving the pulling of the tongue. You tie a rope around, or you tie a bit of cloth around the tongue and pull that, and it's meant to make Kundalini rise. So when you look at the corrupted versions of the descriptions of the same practice in later texts, makes it all make sense. But again, Goraksha is only mentioned in the first verse, and in the verses that the Hatha Pradipika uses from that text, they're not introduced as the work of Goraksha. So again, seems inconclusive. I mean, it seems unlikely that it was originally by Goraksha. I'll just say now that I'm coming back on next Thursday, and I'm going to go more into what I see as the history of the development of the Nath sect. Now I'm just concentrating on the text. So, I mean, is this going to raise a lot of questions, I imagine, but hopefully I'll answer a few of them next week. then there's the Amarago Prabodha, which mentions various siddhas later associated with the Nath order, including Adinatha, Minanatha, and Chauranginatha, and Goraksha. And Bui included this in as one of the texts from which the Hatha Pradipika borrows, but it's only 74 verses long, and several of the verses, I haven't totted it up, but I've identified 30 or 40 from other texts, and in fact there's one 17 verse long section in the middle that's introduced as a borrowing from a text called the Sri Samputta. So it's clearly a compilation itself, and then it just becomes too confusing to try and argue that it's earlier than the Hatha Pradipika. None of the manuscripts are very old. Now, the last two, the Amanuska Yoga and Yoga Bija, are very interesting texts themselves. Jason's editing the Amanuska Yoga, so he knows a lot more about it than I do, but again, within the text, no mention of Nats. The Yoga Bija does mention Nats, and I'll come on to that in a sec, but the Amanuska Yoga, if I'm right, there's no mention of Nats within the text, is there? And the only reason it seems to have been associated with Goraksha is because of a critical edition, or two critical editions, that have come out of Gorakhpur in the last 30 or 40 years from the headquarters of the Nath Sampradaya, who, the text itself is a teaching of yoga from Shiva to the Amuni, isn't it, to Vamadeva, is that right? And within the introductions to these editions, because Shiva and Goraksha are the same, it must be the work of Gorakshanatha. But none of the many manuscripts of the text describe it to Goraksha. And as I say, within the text itself, there's no mention of him or not. And the same has happened with the Yoga Bija. None of the manuscript colophons credit it to Goraksha, but an edition has come out from Gorakhpur. And then these things, they get picked up in secondary literature as well, so in David Gordon White's extensive survey of this field, he says that these two texts are works of Gorakshanatha. Now the Yoga Bija, I'm just going to go into it in a little bit more detail, because it is old, and it does appear to mention Naths in it. And this has been picked up actually by David White in the alchemical body as evidence that, as a mention of the Nath order. So we've got this verse 7 of the Yoga Bija. Badha yena vimuchyante nata marga gataha param tam aham katayashyami tava pritya sureshwari. So I out of fondness for you, tava pritya, O goddess Sureshwari, I shall teach katayashyami that by which the bound souls who are on the nata marga, the path of nata, are liberated. And then again at 189 to 190, just talking about the text itself, so he says, Dātavyam shiva bhakteshu nata marga pareshu cha yoga bijam mahaguhyam yanmaya prakatikritam. So this great secret, the yoga bija, is to be given to devotees of Shiva, shiva bhakteshu, and nata marga pareshu, those devoted to the path of nata. And the goddess replies, Gato me sanseo nata krupaya tava shankara namaste yoga rajaya sarvagyaya namo namaha. Now I have found, in searching through all Sanskrit texts and Hindi works as well, the first clear-cut reference to where nata is obviously being used to name a tradition of yogis is not until the late 18th century, and in every instance it means the Lord, meaning God. Normally, in the case of these kind of texts, Shiva. Obviously, in other traditions, there's three Nathjis, right, Vishnu, and here you see how the goddess answers him with Gato me sanseva nata. My confusion has gone, my Lord Nata, thanks to your compassion, O Shankara. And just to illustrate this, I've put this verse here from the Goraksha Siddhanta Sangraha, which is from about 1600 CE, which is clearly a work of the Nat order, although it wasn't called the Nat order then. And it uses the word Nat, meaning Shiva, throughout the text, but I thought this was quite and here it uses it in the compound Nata Marga, saying Vajra Suchiko Panishad Krita Satu Sarvapi Nata Marga Nusarin Yeva. So talking about the Vajra Suchiko Panishad, which even within the text they would never claim was anything to do with their yogi order. But Nata Marga Nusarini, so it follows the path of Nata, Shiva. It's a Shaiva text. It basically just means Shiva here. And again, there's one more mentioned use of the word Nata in the Yoga Bija, 136 AB. He's just taught a sort of variant of pranayama. And he says, Sa eva Nata Sanketaha, Siddha Sanketa Lakshanaha. That is the Sanketa is a rather difficult word to translate. It seems to mean sort of special yogic techniques, often in the context of Laya Yoga. I haven't sort of worked out a particularly felicitous way of translating it, so convention is the best I can do at the moment. But that is the convention of Nata. That is the mark of the convention of the Siddhas. And again, I think it's White and possibly some others refer to this as this is the convention of the Nats, as in the order of yogis. I've got one parallel here from the Dattatreya Yoga Shastra. Nata seems to be Shiva in the context of these Sanketas. Here, this verse from the Dattatreya Yoga Shastra is Tishtan Gachan Swapan Bunjan Dihayan Shunyam Aharnisham Ayam Eko Hi Sanketa Adinatena Bhashita. Standing, walking, sleeping, eating, meditating on emptiness day and night, this is but one Sanketa, one convention taught by Adinata, taught by Shiva. So again, I think this, the Yoga Bija verses, it's one of the sankhetas of Shiva, one of Shiva's sort of tips, way, clues, ways of getting siddhi.
Isn't it confusing that there are the siddhas, and that's the group that's famous, and also in Tibet and all the siddhas.
Yes.
Natas are often confused.
Yes, no.
And now, Nata is, as you said, is the from Adinata, is Shiva.
Yeah. Yes, I'm going to go into that a bit more next time. But yes, you're right. Throughout, particularly in secondary literature, siddhas are confused with nats. They're thought to be one and the same thing. Whereas, as you say, the whole siddha tradition in Tibet exists completely independently of nats and sort of seems to shoot that down straight away. You know, they would never. As far as I'm aware, I'm no expert, but as far as I'm aware, in Tibet, there's no mention of a Nath tradition, Nath order. Goraksha and Matsyendra or Meena do figure within those siddhas.
Yes.
In the 13th century, they put together the
tales also of the 84. There's also medieval Bengali literature in which these Nathas are mentioned, but not as a Natha.
Well, there's the
Mainamati, etc.
Yes,
stories.
But not the later gurus of the Naths, I don't think.
They don't say Nath, they say Siddhas.
But they don't even, I don't think they mention Goraksha or Matsyendra in the Dohas.
Do.
Well,
but
that's much later,
much
I think. And that's later, I think,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes.
You might be able to help me with this, but I'm not discussing that right now. I've gone into the Bengali literature and I've not found anything early enough to warrant consideration for Nats. No. Again, I'm not an expert, but the secondary literature I've read seems to point that out. And same with Hindi literature. Even the poems attributed to Goraksha or Gorakh, apparently, again, not an expert, but the language of those poems can't be earlier than about the 16th century. So even if they record traces of what he said or some earlier Nath said, we can't be sure. You know. the one sort of vernacular non-Sanskrit text which does seem to teach Hatha Yoga is this last verse on this page that in the Gyaneshwari. There's long sections on yoga, and in fact Goraksha is mentioned within there. But this verse I wanted to draw attention to because it's there's a scholar called Katharina, I think, Keenler, who writes on Marathi literature, and she, on the strength of this verse, wrote an article called The Secret of the Nats. I'm no expert on Marathi, but I'll try and pronounce it. Someone cut me down if I'm getting it wrong. But Pinde Pidacha Grasu Toha Nata Sanketicha Dansu Paridaunugela Udesu Mahavishnu. Now, she translates that as the swallowing of the body by the body, that is the secret of the Nats, this is the secret in the context of the Nats. But here, Mahavishnu gives the explanation. And she then goes on to say that this is, you know, this shows that there was a Nata order in the Maharashtra region at the time. But she then also says that, because this is one of Shiva's sankhetas, but here it's Vishnu who's teaching it. That seems to be what the verse is saying to me. And she actually says that, but then somehow seems to give both meanings. She writes somewhere, instead of being conveyed by Shiva or a Nath teacher, it has been told by Krishna Vishnu, and thus fits into the Bhagavad Gita context, because the Gyaneshwari is a commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. So that quick survey of all those texts leads me on to, having not found any conclusive evidence within this corpus that made me, and elsewhere actually in other sources, which I'll go into a bit next week, that led me to think that that a Nath order existed at that period. I then sort of wanted to think more widely about the texts of this Hatha Yoga corpus. And in fact, almost all of them, very, very few of them betray any kind of sectarian affiliation at all. It's almost like yoga, or the hatha yoga, is a technique that anyone can use, and it doesn't matter what your sectarian affiliation is. I was reading the Sharadatilaka just recently, and I put this verse in here, or this couple of verses. It's the third passage. Atta yogam pravakshyami sangam sambit pradayakam aikyam jivatmano rahur yogam yoga visaradaha. So now I shall teach yoga. And the Sharadatilaka is a sort of fairly encyclopedic tantric work, but others probably know better than me, but it does seem to come from a tantric lineage. But even here it seems to be saying that various people, well, it says, I'll teach you yoga. I'll teach yoga together with its ancillaries, yoga which bestows sambit, sort of higher consciousness or something. Aikyam jivatmano arhur yogam yoga visaradaha. Those who are learned in yoga say that yoga is unity of the jiva and the atman. And then the next line, others, pare viduhu shivatmano abhedena pratipatihi. So it's a realization. Others say that it's a realization through non-division of Shiva and the soul, so unity of Shiva and the soul. And in the commentaries, that first one, there's a 15th century commentary which says that the first line, that first interpretation of yoga, is the Vedanta position. The next one is the Shaiva position. Then we have the Shakta position, Shiva Shaktyatmakam Jnanam Jagur Agama Vedinaha. So those that know the Agamas say that it's knowledge whose essence, it's knowledge of whose essence is Shiva and Shakti. And then the last one is the Vaishnava understanding of yoga. The learned ones, Visharadaha, say that it's knowledge of the ancient man, Purana Purusha, who's Purushottama or Vishnu. So this, it seems interesting to me that they can say that, all these different definitions of yoga, and then they just teach the yoga. So you know, it doesn't matter what you think, but just do the yoga and it'll get you to where you want to go. Now, within the rest of the Hatha yogic corpus, as I said, there's very little that betrays any sectarian identity. The Dattatreya Yoga Shastra here, this verse, these few verses, the numbering's a bit funny because it, in the edition it numbers the line numbers, that's why it's like this. But Brahmana shamano vapi baudho vapi arhato tava kapaliko vacharvakaha sridhaya sahitaha sudihi yoga vyasa rato nityam sarvasiddhim avapnuyat. So whether a Brahmin or a Brahmin ascetic or a Buddhist or a Jaina ascetic or a kapalika or a charvaka, if he's a wise man, sudihi, and has shraddha, faith, devotion, and is eternally devoted to the practice of yoga, he can obtain complete success. Kriya yuktasya siddhi syad akriyasya katam bhavet. Success comes for one who does the practices, kriya yukta, not for one who doesn't practice. Well, how could it happen for one who doesn't practice? And so forth. And later on, there's a verse a bit I'm going to come back to where it says, you know, by wearing of outward sex signs doesn't get you anywhere, which is often repeated in various texts. But the Amanuska Yoga says something similar. I'll just read the first one because they're pretty. These two sections say the same thing, really. Kashaya grahanam kapala dharanam keshavali lunchanam pashandarata basma chivara jata dharitam unmatata nagnatvam nigamagamadi kavita goshti sabhabhyantre sarvam chodara puranarta gartanam nasrayasaha karanam. So the wearing of ochre robes, the carrying of skulls, plucking out your hair, undergoing various heretical vows, wearing ashes, rags, jata, being crazy, being naked, going to gatherings of Vedic and tantric verses, listening to them within sabhabhyantre, in gatherings, in meeting halls. All that is just fulfilling the stomach and doesn't lead to final good. And then again at the bottom is that verse from the Hatha Pradipika that I read earlier. The Hatha Pradipika is a... I'm not going to go into too much of it, but it seems to be... It is definitely a turning point. It seems to be gathering all the information about Hatha Yoga at that time, and as I say, without trying to alienate anyone. But it does... I'm going to come on... I think it's the next passage. We do see a distinction in the text between two types of practitioner. One from a more, not necessarily orthodox tradition, but a more from the sort of great tradition of Hinduism, for want of a better way of putting it, from a Muni tradition, and then the other type of practitioner more from a Siddha tantric tradition. And the Hatha Pradipika does subtly seem to be putting the case of the tantric tradition, and this may be when the fledgling Nath order, even though it wasn't called as such, was perhaps coming together and trying to colonize all Hatha Yoga. But it's a bit early to be definitive about that. But if we move on to the next page, I'll go into these two types of yoga or yogi. Now I'm making this distinction, but it's not clear cut within the texts. Particularly on a linguistic level, because the words Siddha and Muni seem to be interchangeable, and those that I've identified as Munis are often called Siddhas and vice versa. But it does seem to be a useful way of interpreting two approaches to yoga that we find in the text. So I'll go, there's a verse from the Hatha Pradipika here, Vashishtha adhyayascha munibhir matsyendra adhyayascha yogibhihi Angikritanyasanani Katyante Kani Chinmaya. I now shall be told by me some asanas that I accept, that have been accepted Angikritani. Which were put together or something, or adopted by munis such as Vasishtha and yogis such as Matsyendra. Now, as I mentioned earlier, I'm going to get on actually. Time's going. It is 5 minutes fast, isn't it?
Yeah, 5 minutes fast.
As I mentioned earlier, it's rather there's within the few texts that do try and point out different methods and different names of yoga. It all seems to, I haven't managed to make sense of it, and I suspect, particularly in the case of Sharangadhara, that he didn't necessarily make sense of it. He did a pretty good job though. Pinpointing what exactly is Hatha and how that is distinguished from other types of yoga is quite difficult, but there do seem to be these distinctions within the text. So here in the Dattatreya Yoga Shastra, evam ashtanga yogam cha yagyavakyadayo viduhu kapila adhyas tu shishyascha hatam kuryas tato yata. So after teaching, I think there's a mention of ashtanga yoga before this, so thus yagyavakya and others knew Ashtanga Yoga, the eightfold yoga, but Kapila and other pupils practiced Hatha, which is as follows. And then again, Sharangadhara Padati, first couple of verses, Dvidha Hatha Hasyad, Ekastu Gorakshadi Susaditaha, Anyo Murkanda Putradhyay Sadito Nisham Udyate. Hatha is twofold. One is that which was practiced well by Goraksha and others. The other was mastered by the son of Murkanda, i.e. Markandeya, and others who were striving incessantly, constantly. And then it teaches the Hatha attributed to Goraksha. Now, this long passage here, I won't read it out in Sanskrit. I'll read a translation of it. I actually go into it in my Khechari Vidya book. But this passage also in the Sharangadhara Padati, which I haven't located in any other text. I think it's Sharangadhara, the compiler himself, analysing what he's found and trying to make sense of it. I'll come back to that in a sec. He's trying to analyse what he says. Okay, I'll read you my translation. So there's two types, and this is the first one, which I... which seems to go with this Muni tradition, seems to be part of that. And the second type is more the tantric siddha tradition. So the first one, the yogin should insert the previously trained mind and breath into the Shankini Nadi in the rod-like pathway at the rear by contracting the Muladhara. Breaking the three knots, he should lead mind and breath to the bee cave. Then the bindu born of nada goes from there to dissolution in the void. Through training, the yogin becomes one whose destiny is assured, chaste, supremely blissful, and free of old age and death. So there's no mention of chakras in here. Kundalini doesn't figure. It's raising the breath. And the idea seems to be of raising the breath and the mind upwards and keeping it there. And it's linked with celibacy and liberation as well. Moksha, although not here, but seems to be the aim of these techniques. And then the second one, or by upward impulses of the breath, the yogin should awaken the sleeping goddess Kundalini, whose abode is the base and whose form is like a lotus fibre. Inserting her into the Sushumna Nadi, he should pierce the five chakras. Then he should insert the goddess into Shiva, who has the radiance of the moon, a shining faultless light in the thousand-petaled lotus, and flood his entire body inside and out with the nectar there. Then the yogin should think of nothing. Now, these two different approaches, it's a useful way of understanding some of the yogas taught in certain texts, but then at a later point they seem to get mixed up quite a lot. So, for example, in the Hatha Pradipika, which takes verses from all over the place, you often get conflicting approaches going. It was very, with the Khetri Vidya, whose main technique is Khetri Mudra, which involves putting the tongue back and into the aperture above the palate, and it's meant to help Kundalini rise up. You see within the text, within the early text, some say that you're doing that to block the Amrita in the head. Then other texts say you're doing it in order to access that Amrita and flood the body. And these seem to be coming from these two different traditions. And there are other practices with similar distinctions going on. This distinction is not always that clear, and it gets quite confused later on. But I do think I've got a little paragraph here from Alexis Sanderson writing about Shaivism from an earlier period, but it seems to fit this distinction. Shaivism, in its great internal diversity, is the result of the interplay of two fundamental orientations: a liberation-seeking asceticism embodied in the Ati Marga and a power-seeking asceticism of Karpalika character within the Mantra Marga. And this first, what I've been calling the Muni-style yoga, is best represented by the Dattatreya Yoga Shastra, which I'm going to return to in a minute. I just realized I missed out rather an important quote I wanted to make when I was talking about the non-sectarianism of the text of yoga. Kshaba Kis, who I mentioned earlier, he in his edition of the Matsyendra Sanghita, or an article he's written about, it's not yet published, but he wrote about the text cult, the cult of the text, of the cult that represented in the Matsyendra Sanghita, said it represents a phase in the history of yoga when yogic teachings try to become detached, perhaps not for the first time, from the mainstream religion, in this case tantric Shaivism, by eliminating sectarian boundaries through the concealment of sectarian marks such as easily decodable deity names, mantras and iconography, and to prepare for a formative period of a pan-Indian yoga which can again become an alternative for the official conservative religion. This seems to be the process that has eventually produced the well-known chakra-centered Hatha yogic traditions, devoid of any definite claim to belong to any early tantric cult. And with reference to all this Hatha yogic corpus, they do indeed, none of the texts makes any mention, they don't, you know, all the earlier tantric works dwell on these complicated mantras that you need to know to be part of a particular cult, and they have these secret ways of explaining them. There's none of that in Hatha yoga. The only mantra you really come across is what's called the Ajapa Gayatri, which is just the in and out breath, Soham Mantra. And same with mandalas, there's no mandala. Occasional, you know, in the chakras later on, there's ideas of mandala. And metaphysics too is not found in the corpus. And this, Al, I'm going to talk more about it next week, but the way I see it is that the yogis at this time were pretty much a fairly amorphous, sort of homogenous bunch, and didn't particularly, they were reacting against the sectarianism, the exclusivity of earlier cults, this probably prefigured as well the sort of Niraguna Bhakti of the saints and a more open approach to religion, to the devotional religion at the time. And also in travellers' accounts from up to 1600, and in Persian accounts, normally coming from Persian historians and accounts of Indian religion, the yogis are just one big bunch. No, they don't make any distinction between them. So that seems to be the general position, but this last section I'm going to come on to here, it's just within that, I'm going to concentrate on the text, on the Muni side, this Muni type of yoga that I've identified. And in particular Dattatreya and Kapila, who are mentioned in these texts. There's this long passage here from the Markandeya Purana. I won't bother translating it all, but it's describing Dattatreya, the yogi Dattatreya, who obviously is the teacher in the Dattatreya Yoga Shastra, but this is from the Markandeya Purana. And it describes how there's these various young Muni boys who, because he's such a wonderful yogi, won't leave him alone, and he thinks that if he dives underwater and he spends, 100 years of the gods in the lake, and then he comes out and they're still there waiting for him. So then verse 20, Tato divyambara dharam charu pina nitambanim nari madaya kalyanim utitara jalan munahi. So then he takes a beautiful woman out of the lake and starts making love to her, thinking they'll be so shocked they'll leave him alone. But they don't. And then he starts drinking with her and he gets drunk. And then he's getting to drinking, listening to music, and they still won't go. Because at the end they know that he's such a great yogi that such things won't affect him, and also notably significantly, he's also said, whilst he's doing all this, the second last line, tapas tete sat yogavit, with his wife he practiced austerities, because within this Muni tradition there's also seems to be an emphasis on tapas, which is not found within the Nart text at all. Not even to this day, Narts are never known for practicing any austerities. And then, interesting, there's a verse I came across when I was translating the Brihatkatha Shloka Sangraha in the context of Kapila. Yena doshena sansara paritrasyanti mokshavaha satasmin moksha shastreshu shruyate kapiladibihi. And that's describing the city of a king called Chanda Singha. And so tasmin means in that city. There, the vices, this is how I translated, there, the vices that usually terrify those who want to be liberated from the wheel of rebirth are prescribed by Kapila and others in treatises on liberation. So both Dattatreya and Kapila have reputations as yogis who also practice asceticism and various sort of antinomian practices, which I'll come on to here. This next couple of three lines from the Dattatreya Yoga Shastra. Kavi margo yamuktaste sankrate ashtanga yogataha. So that was the way of the kavis, of the wizards or the poets or something, the ashtanga yoga. Siddhanam kapiladinam matam vakshe tataha param. Now I shall teach the doctrine of siddhas such as Kapila. Abhyasa bhedato bhedaha palam tu samamevahi. The difference is a difference in practice, the reward is the same. And then he goes on to teach the 10 mudras that became famous in Hatha Yoga, including, which I think is quite significant, the Vajroli mudra, which became rather famous and sort of infamous as well, is in later translations of lots of texts is left out, and, which involves sucking liquids back up the urethra in various different contexts. That same practice is not found in any of the texts later attributed to Goraksha. And as far as I'm aware, most of the other practices of Hatha Yoga, their antecedents can be found in tantric works, but this one I don't think can, Vajrayali Mudra. So I'm thinking there's another lineage of yoga practicing munis. Then this last passage is the last one, a couple more. Well, this is just to illustrate, I won't translate because we're running out of time, but just to illustrate how in the last line of this passage, when couple is, this is from the Bhagavata Purana, when couple is teaching yoga, and he talks about achieving liberation, tapo yuktena yogena, by yoga joined with tapas. Again, just to illustrate this idea of yoga and tapas together, which is not found at all within the Nath tradition. And then elsewhere in the text, talking about the tapas of King Prithu, I just put this in because it mentions various austerities, sort of diet. Well, I'll read out the first few lines. Kanda mula phalahara, shushka paranashinaha kwachit, abhakshaha katichit pakshan, vayu bhakshas tataha param. Grishme panchatapa viro, varsha suasara shan munihi, akanta magnaha shishire, udike standileshayaha, and so on. But eating bulbs and roots and fruits and or dried up leaves sometimes, and sometimes not eating anything for a few weeks, and then finally eating just air in the hot season, being panchatapa, which means being surrounded by five fires. Then in the cold season, the muni exposes himself to downpours, and he immerses himself in freezing water up to his neck and sleeps on the open ground, and so on. And it's also Urdhvareta, again, celibate. Now, all these practices are still found today amongst, I'm going to go into this in a lot more detail next week, but there are various orders of ascetics still around today who practice Hatha Yoga, including the Dasanami Sannyasis, the Ramanandis, the Udasins, and the Naths. So they're the sort of biggest ascetic orders around today, and they still practice Hatha Yoga. And those three, not the Naths, all do these very practices. And in particular, this whole tradition seems to be associated with the Dasanami Sannyasins. There are two main akaras. They're split into seven akaras, and the biggest is the Juna akara, and their Ishta Devata is Dattatreya. And then I'm not sure if it's the next biggest numerically, but the most senior one, the one that was bathed first at all the Kumbh Melas and stuff, is the Mahanirvani akara, and their Ishta Devata is Kapila. And they do all these practices. They practice yoga, and these austerities, these types of tapas. Now I want to go back, finally, the last bit of verse from the Dattatreya Yoga Shastra. This section here, Mundito Dandadhari wa Kashaya Vasanopi wa Narayana Vado wa Pijatilo Bhasmalepanaha Namaha Shivaya Vachi wa Bahyarcha Pujikopi wa Sthana Dvadasha Pujo wa Bahu Vatsala Pujito Kriyahino Tva Kruraha Katam Siddhim Avapniya. So shaven-headed, mundito, holding a stick, or wearing ochre robes, or saying Narayana, or having jata, or being smeared in ash, or saying Namaha Shivaya, or performing external worship, Bahyarcha Pujako, or worshipping at the 12 sthanas, the 12 places, or being Bahu Vatsala Pujita, I think probably being worshipped by lots of devotees. Kriyahino, if you don't practice, or if you're kruraha, you're cruel. Doesn't that normally mean if you're doing sort of sacrifices and stuff, isn't it? How can you attain siddhi? Now, all these epithets can still to this day be applied to the Dasanami sannyasis. I mean, quite particularly, especially what this Narayana Vado, because it's always perplexed me. And funnily enough, a friend of mine called Matthew Clark dropped by yesterday, who's he's done lots of work on the Dasanami sannyasis. And so I was quizzing him about why these sannyasis, the Shaiva sannyasis, all greet each other with Om Namo Narayan. And he said he'd looked into it a lot and he'd asked around a lot and no one had ever given him any satisfactory answer. But here it's mentioned, and it just occurred to me that perhaps it's something to do with the fact that both Kapila and Dattatreya are incarnations of Vishnu as Narayan. But yes, all these, and then this, and they also say Om Namah Shivaya, obviously, all the time. That's understandable as Shaivas. And the Sthana Dwadasha Puja, I presume, means going to the 12 Jyotirlinga temples of Shiva.
I think the bodily works, Dadasha, that sort of Vaishnavas, Sri Vaishnavas and all that.
Yes. Ah, is that right?
That's what I thought also.
Yes. Okay. I said that would be set, but that wouldn't be a Shaiva practice. Okay. Interesting. And so, yes, well, so sort of start summing up. On this section, as well as the Dattatreya Yoga Shastra, there's another early yoga text called the Shiva Sanghita, which also, as I said earlier, makes no mention of Narts and teaches gives a Vedantic flavored yoga but it does in certain places betray some allegiance with the Sri Vidya tradition of South India. There's mentions of Tripura Sundari and Tripura Bhairavi, and that's the extent, you know, that, and it seems to have been composed in Varanasi, but that again, the Dasanami sannyasis, some of them still practice Sri Vidya style Vedantic, engage in Sri Vidya style Vedantic practices through, there's a link with their four, where their four Shankaracharyas live, particularly in the south at Sringeri and Kanchi, they practice Sri Vidya down there. So I'm saying that, you know, there's this stream of Hatha yogic practice that seems to be much more associated with this Dasanami tradition, and also some of these practices figure with amongst the Ramanandis and the Udasins, but it looks like the Dasanami tradition is probably older. So I've just written a paragraph here to sum up. I was worried I might run out of time, but I think I'm just almost, but I'll read it anyway. Just to, contrary to what we read almost universally in secondary literature and in the pronouncements of the order itself, there is no evidence that members of a Nath Sampradaya wrote any of the texts on Hatha Yoga which predate the c. 1450 Hatha Pradipika. This is not to say that none of the gurus later claimed by the Nath Sampradaya to have been their predecessors lived and taught during that period, just that none of them wrote any texts or founded an order. The rise to prominence of Hatha Yoga in the early medieval period can be seen as a reaction against the exclusivity and complexity of tantric cults and rites. Its techniques meant that its practitioners needed neither ritual paraphernalia nor intermediaries. The early Hatha yogins were opposed to sectarianism, and their texts portray little in the way of sectarian affiliation. This lack of sectarianism or dogma in the texts and practices meant that the former could later be appropriated by the Narts and others, and that the latter, the practices could be adopted by a wide range of would-be yogis, such as medieval Sufis or modern New Age practitioners of yoga. And I think what I was meant to mention earlier was the lack of overt dogma or sectarianism within the text made them much easier to be appropriated at a later date by Upanishad Rama Yogin or by these various Persian schools, Islamic schools that took them on. You know, the lots of Sufi orders, they translated plenty of Hatha yogic texts and they had no problems with that. It wasn't seen as though they were then also adopting some dogma that went with them. And what can be discerned in the text, however, are two different varieties of Hatha Yoga, one rooted in the tradition of Munis such as Kapila and Dattatreya, the other in the Tantric Siddha tradition. When the yogis' sectarian identities coalesced in the 15th and 16th centuries, the former variety was that practiced by the Dasanami sannyasis and Ramanandis, the latter that by the Naths. That practiced by the more orthodox Dasanamis and Ramanandis puts emphasis on celibacy and asceticism and the quest for liberation. That practiced by the Narts is more siddhi-oriented. The Narts have, for for a long time been considered the heirs of the original Hatha Yogis. Since they now resemble, in the words of Masaya Eliade, translated, a sect in decomposition, trying to learn about Hatha Yoga through today's Nats is a futile task. However, members of the Dasanavi Sannyasis, Ramanandi, and the Dasanavi Sannyasi, Ramanandi, and Udasin Sampradayas, which are all flourishing, still practice Hatha Yoga, and they can be studied as heirs to the original Hatha Yogic tradition, rather than as practitioners of an adulterated form of Nat Yoga. That's it, actually. I'm just going to say next week's going to be very different. It's not going to be a handout full of Sanskrit verses. It's going to be slides of pictures of yogis mainly and their various accoutrements as I try and trace the development of the sects themselves and concentrate on the Nats and explore how they managed to appropriate Hatha Yoga. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed. I think that deserves a round of applause. We're supposed to technically stop at 3, but I think if we have a 10 to 15 minutes of questions, if everybody's happy to stay for that. Next week we have until 3:30. So, if you have a pressing question that you'd like to address Dr. Mallinson, please do.
Sandra. Thanks, that's wonderful. Two questions. One is, what historical events would have happened in the 15th, 16th century to bring those strands together?
Well, actually, Matthew Clark, who I mentioned, he writes about that quite extensively in his book on the Dasanavis, and within the tradition, they say that it's because they were being oppressed by the Muslims and they had to organise themselves and so that they could fight back, which possibly is partly true, but also the Sufi orders, what Matthew writes about is how I think there's a broad picture of religious identity kind of becoming more of an issue at that period. And next week or 2 weeks' time, there's a conference, I think, in the Oriental Institute covering that quite a lot. And the Sufi orders, they began I'm not a historian, and I'm venturing into muddy waters, but as the Mughals took control over North India, and then the Sufi orders correspondingly gained greater power. And they were very organized. They'd brought sort of fairly organizational systems with them. They were split into 14 groups. I can't remember exactly what they're called. And Matthew argues that in order to compete with them, the other ascetic orders had to get more organized. And he then shows fairly convincingly that they, particularly in the case of the Dasanavis, they modelled their organisation on that of the Sufi orders, but they had 10. And the Nats had 12 punts, which I'm going to go into next week.
And the second question maybe follows on from that in a sense. At some point, it strikes me, though, that the Dasanavi orders, they still engage in the tapas practices,
sure,
very explicitly, that you translated so wonderfully for us. But they don't engage nearly as much as other orders, including Nath orders, in what we would currently identify as Hatha Yoga.
As yoga, well.
I mean, some might engage in meditative practices,
sure,
and mantra practices, but
sure,
many fewer than in, say, Ramanandi orders or in Nath.
Do you think? I've not done extensive field work amongst the Naths, but I have tried quite a few times to find Naths who practice yoga, and I've always been told no one does anymore. I don't know if you can.
Well, some of Gauri lineages.
Right.
Certainly, much more than I would say Dasanavi lineage.
Okay.
But for example, the five fire rituals.
Well, that's Ramanandi, yeah.
That's Ramanandi,
yeah.
Right. So
they seem to, the various different austerities have gone with certain, with different orders. So the Ramanandis do the five fires. I think only the Sannyasis do the Urdhva Bahu these days.
Sure.
The Ramanandis stand up, do the Kaleshwari.
Definitely.
As far as
those practices you would identify as yoga, I've seen it much more among. Not particularly, I would say, Agori particularly.
Right.
And not really so much evidence among the Dasanavis.
I think you're right amongst the Nagas.
The relation should be drawn between tapas and physical yoga practice. I don't know.
I think what we do see, though, is that a lot of the, Elizabeth knows more about this than me, but a lot of the the modern teachers of yoga in India seem to come from the sannyasis, don't they? There's Swami Satyananda and the,
never thought about it like that.
Whereas you don't have any Nath teachers of yoga, these big schools of yoga anymore.
Well, there's one that could have been,
is there?
I remember, but just one flashes in my mind as an advert.
The Swami, is it Satyananda and Shivananda, they're all
Dasanandas.
But that is more of a sort of on an orthodox level. You're right, the wandering Nagas don't seem to practice it so much. But amongst all these wandering groups, it's not practiced so much. Even amongst the Ramanandis, I did most of my field work, it's pretty few, they're few and far between, but they are there, you know, there is a tradition of it. They're pretty late development anyway, they're 19th century. I don't know.
Do they ultimately go to Dattatreya now?
Yes, that's true. They're,
yes.
So
where do they come in?
Where did they, what were their affiliation with Dattatreya? Well, that seems to be the sort of Nath Dattatreya connection seems to be very late, and it possibly stems from Maharashtra, where there was a system of nine Narayanas was identified, was conflated with the nine Naths, but this is the 18th century. Because in 16th, 17th century reports, Dattatreya and the Naths are generally opposed. There's lots of stories of Goraksha and Dattatreya fighting, you know, having Siddhi battles, and Dattatreya normally wins. A few weeks ago, I was in a place in Himachal called Baba Balak Nath, which strangely for the name is very much Dasnami center, and always has been, as far as I can make out. I mean, it may be at some point, but all the legends, I found no legends suggesting anything other than that he was a Dasnami from the beginning, because they say he was initiated by Dattatreya. He probably lived at the beginning of the 17th century, and then there's lots of different myths of Goraknath. One, you know, he's such a great yogi that Goraknath wants him to become a Nath, and he's trying to get his knives in his ears, but they won't pierce.
Because that part is alive. So we went in
with the Aghori part.
Nepal, yeah, and met one of the Aghoris practicing tapas in the Bhavani temple, and completely by himself with just a fire. Doesn't go out to us. Somebody gives him something to eat. He eats. Now then, he doesn't.
Right. And he was a Kinarami.
He said Aghori.
Right.
And he was from North India somewhere. So they're alive.
Sure, there is Aghoris, and there's plenty of Naths as well. And there's plenty of wonderful charismatic Naths too. It's just the I'm going to try and talk about this more next week, but they seem to have rather successfully cornered the market at some point in all these texts that slowly getting appropriated by them, and you see the change in the within the texts themselves. If you look at this Viveka Marthanda in particular that I was saying about, it's been comprehensively appropriated. But yes, I don't want to completely, there's plenty of wonderful Naths around. It's just their history seems to have been somewhat embellished.
Somewhere there is a connection between Ramakrishna and one of the Nath Aghoris, centered from somewhere near Punjab or so, who was his first guru.
Right.
And it was there. So at least 19th century, it was still going strong.
No, there's lots of reports of Aghoris from the 19th century. So I'm just looking at some rather wonderful pictures in the British Museum of some rather funky looking Aghori.
Going backwards a bit, I was wondering, in terms of this transition from not as generically Shaiva into not as institutionally lineage based and so on.
Mm.
I was wondering if you could sort of sharpen for us what your historical perspective is, say, in terms of distinction to David White and what he's done with this Kaula early whole, and it was doctrinally, where do you see this not appropriation sort of emerging, or
where or when
both? I mean,
I'm not sure, but
do you see it in any different terms than he's talking about, in other words? Sort of asking you to stick your neck out.
Yeah, yeah. No, very much so. I mean, he writes, I've got a couple of quotes, because he contradicts himself in that book, but he writes that Goraknath founded the Nath order in the 13th century and brought all these different groups together then, there and then, whereas, and wrote all these texts. So I would completely argue against that. Haru Nugget Isaacson just sent me a passage making reference to Goraksha, which can be dated to 1205, which is very interesting. He's obviously already quite established by then, so that puts his date back a bit. And I, you know, don't deny that he lived and was a great yogi. It's just I don't think he founded this Anart order, and that they all these different groups came together. Then I think the different groups stayed doing their own thing until a much later period.
So the emergence of the Anarts are just is just a much more amorphous kind of.
Well, they then come together in the 16th century, and it becomes organized, and there seems to be lots of different groups brought in, and then. As he says, as David White says in his book, lots of different groups did get absorbed into the Nath in particular, seem to be more eclectic, including alchemists and various other types. He lists them all. But I think he then reads back, because then these alchemists and yogis and snake charmers and whatever were all in one group, he then reads back into the earlier period that they were all one and the same. This is where he has his thesis that
the Kalda, I'm also wondering how that
I'm sure
designation that, fits into any of this.
I don't think the Narts would have called themselves Kalda.
Yeah.
And I think also when he reads back into one of the theses of that book is that the alchemists and the Hatha yogis were the same.
Thank you. We should wind up now, but do come along next week if you have more questions as well. And I'd like to thank you very much indeed for a very interesting talk. And it strikes me that I'd always assumed that the Nats and the Hatha Yogas were connected up, you know, but it strikes me that the way that you've got to pay particular attention to what the texts say.
Yeah.
And this is a great lesson in that. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do come along next week, everyone. Thank you.